Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1998. Superman, Volkswagen, and Lazar Kaganovich.
Hello. I have a number of news reports on my desk, which have come to me from around the world during the past couple of weeks. These reports deal with various events in a half dozen countries, but they all have one element in common: organized Jewish groups with their hands out, demanding money, demanding sympathy, demanding the punishment of their critics. Some of these reports reveal an arrogance and a greed and a pushiness so extreme as to be almost comical. For example, a couple of recent issues of Superman Comics, issues 81 and 82 to be exact, had Superman fighting the Germans in the Warsaw Ghetto back in the 1940s. The Germans were the bad guys, and the residents of the ghetto, who had names like Baruch and Moishe and were shown wearing yarmulkes, were the good guys. Superman was saving Moishe and Baruch from being shipped off to a concentration camp by the Germans. Pretty standard pro-Jewish, anti-German Holocaust propaganda of the sort we've been seeing for the past 60 years, right? Well, organized Jewish groups weren't happy with it because the good guys weren't identified explicitly as Jews. Moishe and Baruch and the yarmulkes weren't explicit enough. The word Jew wasn't used. The Jews are concerned that a child reading the comic books, who had never seen a yarmulke and who didn't know that the names Moishe and Baruch are strictly kosher, might think that the people Superman was saving were Poles instead of Jews. The Poles might get some undeserved sympathy from the reader as victims of the Germans. And the Jews always have demanded that they be given all of the sympathy connected with the so-called Holocaust. They don't want anyone else horning in on their victim status. Kenneth Jacobson of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, the largest and most powerful Jewish pressure group in America, called the Superman comics depiction of the Holocaust outrageous. That's the word he used, outrageous. He complained that it is an insult to the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust because it didn't use the word Jew. Another B'nai B'rith official, Myrna Scheinbaum, said, and I quote, "We found it extremely offensive that in what was to have been a positive teaching lesson, Jews were not mentioned. You can't be general when you talk about victims of the Holocaust," end of quote. One might think that she and Jacobson were lecturing an anti-Semite for his insensitivity. Actually, however, DC Comics, the company which publishes Superman comics, is a completely Jewish outfit, like most of the other major publishers of children's magazines in America. The president and editor-in-chief of DC Comics is a Jewess, Jeanette Kahn. So what we were seeing in this particular tempest in a teapot was the Jews grabbing yet another chance to remind all of us once again about how much they have suffered, poor dears, and about how we must never forget it. And why this victim status is so jealously guarded by the Jews was brought out in another news report which came in a few days ago. This was a report that the Volkswagen company, Germany's largest automaker, has caved in to Jewish demands and now will pay compensation to Jews who worked involuntarily for Volkswagen during the Second World War. You know, that's the war during which all of the Jews in Germany supposedly were gassed and cremated. Volkswagen employed 15,000 non-German workers during the war, and they often are referred to by the media as slave laborers. Only a small fraction of these workers were Jews. All of them were fed and housed, and many of them had relative freedom of movement during their non-working hours. But they had been dragooned from other countries to help the Germans deal with their severe labor shortage during the war, and they certainly weren't paid union scale. So a few months ago, the Jews among these wartime Volkswagen workers demanded that they be paid for their work, plus interest, of course. Volkswagen initially told them to shove off. It was not Volkswagen which had forced them to work. It was the German government, Volkswagen officials said. Besides, that was more than 53 years ago. If they had a valid claim, they should have presented it sooner. Well, the Jews, all of whom now live in Israel, threatened to sue and to make other difficulties for Volkswagen if their demands weren't met. You want to sell cars in the United States? Then you pay us, the Jews threatened. 2 weeks ago, Volkswagen, seeing how government officials in the United States were dancing to the Jews' tune in applying pressure to Switzerland in connection with Jewish claims against that country, caved in and agreed to pay. It seems cheaper to Volkswagen than having the Jews mount the same sort of worldwide propaganda campaign against the company that it has mounted against Swiss banks. I've talked on several earlier programs about the Jewish extortion effort against the Swiss. And now one can begin to see how all of these demands for money hang together. Just as I told you the last time I spoke with you on the subject, 3 weeks ago, I believe, when the Swiss had made an offer of $600 million to the Jews and the Jews had pretended to be insulted by such a paltry offer, the Jews figured that they could turn up the pressure and get a lot more than $600 million out of the Swiss. And that's what they've done. They've got all of their bought politicians in the United States starting boycott legislation of one sort or another against the Swiss. Not only will Swiss banks be barred from doing business in various parts of the United States, but other Swiss companies will be punished as well until the Swiss cough up every cent the Jews are demanding. We are being used. That is, our public institutions are being used by the Jews to get what they want, as if these institutions belonged to the Jews and were theirs to use and abuse for their purposes. And you see, it's important for the Jews to make an example of the Swiss. That's what made Volkswagen decide to cough up. That's what the Jews figure will make the Swedes and the French and the Portuguese and the Spanish and everyone else cough up. They are demonstrating their ability to use the power of government in the United States to coerce anyone who doesn't yield voluntarily to their demands for money. And they're able to use the U.S. government like this because they kept the American public feeling sorry for them as Holocaust victims. That's why they raised such a stink when Superman failed to state explicitly that Moshe and Baruch are Jews. As I said, it all hangs together. The notion that the world owes the Jews for what they claim happened to them more than half a century ago has interesting implications, and we've talked about this briefly on earlier programs. But I've just finished reading a book which really casts a lot of light on the whole concept of reparations and on the question of who owes whom. The book is a biography of Lazar Kaganovich, one of the bloodiest of the communist butchers during the 1930s and 1940s, and the number two man in the Kremlin for many years. The book is The Wolf of the Kremlin, and it was written by Stuart Kahan, an American Jew who is Kaganovich's nephew. Kahan went to the Soviet Union in 1981 and interviewed his uncle extensively in Yiddish to write this biography, and it is a gold mine of revelations. To sum it up, Lazar Kaganovich was a Jew raised in the Jewish tradition, a yeshiva boy taught to guide himself on the basis of doing always what is best for the Jews. And this precept actually is cited explicitly several times in the book. He attended his first Communist Party meeting in 1911 when he was 18 to hear the Jewish communist Trotsky give a speech in a synagogue in Kiev. That's right, in a synagogue. He rose rapidly in the inner circle of the Communist Party, which contained many more Jews than Gentiles. His success was due primarily to his aggressiveness and his ruthlessness. In his communist activity, he held back from nothing, no matter how brutal or bloody. He even killed his fellow Jews when they got in his way. He was a gangster among gangsters. In 1930, Kaganovich organized a special department of the Soviet secret police, with himself as the head. It was referred to as the Department of Wet Affairs, with wet meaning bloody. That is, it handled clandestine mass executions of the sort carried out later at Vinnytsia in Ukraine and at Katyn in Russia and at 1,000 other places throughout the Soviet Union over the next two decades. Kaganovich became the commissar in charge of mass murder. Yet when the German army invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, it was Kaganovich who was the savior of the Jews. He arranged for the evacuation of all Jews from the frontier areas and their resettlement far to the east, where they would be safe from the Germans. Let the Ukrainians and the Russians bear the brunt of the German invasion, but protect the Jews from hardship and danger at any cost. And Kaganovich boasts that he saved the Jews once again in 1953, when Stalin was planning to rid Russia of them by arranging for Stalin to be poisoned. He and his sister Rosa, who was a doctor, devised a scheme to switch pills in Stalin's medicine cabinet so that he would have a fatal stroke, which he did. When the Gentile communist Nikita Khrushchev accused Kaganovich in 1957 at a Soviet Party Congress of having murdered 20 million Russians during his career, Kaganovich didn't even deny it. He only accused Khrushchev of being a murderer too. "Your hands are blood-stained too," Kaganovich told him. Khrushchev pointed out that the difference was that he, Khrushchev, had merely followed Kaganovich's orders, while it had been Kaganovich who had formulated the policies of mass murder and had given the orders for carrying out those policies. As I said, it's a fascinating book, this biography of Lazar Kaganovich. And if you really want to gain some insight into the Jewish mentality, into the way they justify themselves, into the way they view the non-Jewish world, you should read it for yourself. Kaganovich wants to boast about the power he once held, and at the same time he wants to evade responsibility for his crimes. And one can see this ambivalent attitude throughout the book. Now the point of all this is that Kaganovich did manage to evade responsibility. He was permitted to retire and to live out his life in comfort in Moscow. He was expelled from the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in 1957 when he lost a power struggle with Khrushchev, and he was kicked out of the Communist Party itself in 1962. So Kaganovich simply retired from the business of mass murder and then lived in peace and relative luxury for nearly 30 more years until his death in 1991 at the age of 98. Not even the publication of his nephew's biography of him in 1987, with all of its revelations of his crimes, brought a public demand that he be punished. Not even after the collapse of communism did anyone call him to account for his genocide against the Russian and Ukrainian people. Suppose that instead of being a Jew who murdered 20 million Gentiles, he had been a German accused of killing just 100 Jews. Can't you imagine the screams from the media around the world that he be put on trial and punished? Can't you imagine the hysterical demands for revenge from the Jews, the non-stop demonstrations in front of German embassies everywhere? Such a wonderful opportunity to remind everyone about the Holocaust and how the poor innocent Jews had suffered and how the world now owed them reparations. Such an opportunity certainly would not go unexploited. But in the case of Lazar Kaganovich, only silence, only disinterest by the media. Interesting, isn't it? Now, you and I understand the reason for this difference, don't we? We've discussed it a number of times on these programs. We understand that the Holocaust story is important to the Jews because they are able to milk the Gentile world for billions of dollars every year by keeping the Gentiles feeling guilty for letting it happen. And we understand why the Jews don't feel guilty for having unleashed communism on the world, just as they don't feel guilty for having spawned monsters like Lazar Kaganovich. They really believe that only their lives count, not ours. And I should add that we understand why the Germans, back before the Second World War, really wanted to get the Jews out of their country and off their backs. And we understand why Stalin decided in 1953 that he would leave as his gift to the Russian people something that they would be eternally grateful for by getting rid of every Jew in the Soviet Union. So the question now is, what can we do to free ourselves from the Jews? What can we do to break their death grip on our mass media of news and entertainment and on our political system? How can we bring about an end to their racket of using us to extort money from the rest of the world for them? Well, I'll tell you, one thing we can't do is make an appeal to our elected leaders in Washington. Most of the politicians understand quite well what's going on, but they don't care about anything that's going on unless it's an issue in the mass media or can be made into an issue in the mass media and they can figure a way to get votes from it. About the only difference between Bill Clinton and the rest of the gang in Washington, Republicans as well as Democrats, is that Bill Clinton has more charisma. If we had an honest, patriotic government, they'd all be gallows bait. Another bunch we can't count on are businessmen, like the people who run Volkswagen or the Swiss banks. Generally, these are pretty smart people, and they understand the same things that we understand. But just as the politicians don't care about anything except votes, these big businessmen don't care about anything except profits. The Volkswagen people understand that if anyone owes something, the Jews who worked in their plant during the war owe Volkswagen for keeping them alive and permitting them to survive the war in one piece. But they won't say that publicly, because as long as the Jews control the media and the government in America, there's no profit in that. And the same for the Swiss bankers. In fact, There's more than a possible loss of profit involved. There are hundreds of people sitting in prisons in Germany and Switzerland now because they dared to speak the truth about the Jews and thus violated so-called hate laws the Jews had their balk politicians in those countries enact for the specific purpose of silencing those who would expose them. An example is Rudolf Keller, a member of the nationalist Swiss Democratic Party, who was arrested earlier this month in Zurich and charged with being a hate criminal. Mr. Keller's crime was announcing publicly that if the Jews proceed with their anti-Swiss boycotts in America, then the Swiss people should, in reprisal, refuse to buy any American-made goods, shop in stores or eat in restaurants owned by Jews, or take vacations in America or Israel. The politicians who had him arrested claimed that Keller's announcement might incite race hatred against the Jews. And in Switzerland, Germany, and many other countries, the Jews already have arranged for that to be illegal. They're working hard to have similar laws enacted in America. So what can we do? Listen, not everyone in America is a politician or a businessman. And not everyone is a couch potato who is incapable of understanding anything which doesn't come to him directly from his television screen. There still are decent, honest, and rational people in America. People who are capable of understanding if one makes information available to them and who will care once they understand. Believe me, you and I aren't the only ones. There are enough good people left to upset the Jews' apple cart if we do our part. And our part is to reach these decent people and help them understand. And you know, we can do that. I can keep on presenting facts of the sort I've brought out today, facts which will help people understand, among other things, who is persecuting whom, who owes whom. And this is important because most of these decent, rational Americans have never heard the things about Lazar Kaganovich, which we discussed today. Most of these decent people are too busy with their own lives to pay attention to the current Jewish campaign to silence their critics with new laws against what they call hate speech. They need to be told. They need to be made to pay attention. And you can help make them pay attention. I'll keep presenting the facts. You get other people to listen. I'll bet you know at least 5 decent people who are not listening to American distant voices now. You get them to start listening. Do whatever you have to, but get them to start paying attention. Thanks for being with me again today.